there. This is Rheta Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Corporations like Monsanto and PepsiCo are pumping millions of dollars into Oregon to defeat a measure on this election's ballot that would require labeling of genetically engineered raw and packaged food. Why is Big Ag so determined to stop GMO labeling? This morning we're talking with Julia DeGraw, who is with Food and Water Watch. We're going to talk about Ballot Measure 92, one of several initiatives on the ballot you recently received in the mail. We'll talk about what the act will really do as opposed to what the opposition is saying about it and why Big Ag is trying to scare Oregonians into voting no. Julia, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by just talking a little bit. What are GMOs and why are you concerned about eating them and not knowing that you're eating them?
Well, I'm really glad we started with this question because I think there's often a lot of misinformation about what a GMO or genetically engineered food actually is. So, some people will make this argument that hybridization is genetic modification, and that is not the definition that this bill is operating on or that this law is operating on. We're using the standard international definition for genetically engineered, and it has to do with foods that are made in a lab. It's you're taking a gene from a completely different species and injecting it into another species, and therefore, really, frankly, creating a whole new species that hadn't existed before in a lab. And these things are different enough for these companies to patent them, and we really think, well, if it's different enough to patent this different species, then it certainly should be different enough for a label on food.
Now, I want to get back to that confusion between hybridization and GMOs, because I remember back when there was a GMO labeling initiative on the ballot, what was it, like 2002? It was a long time ago.
It was a while ago.
And the cell would be, bless their heart, had an editorial against the initiative, and the editor of the Cell Would Be threw up the whole concern that it would require labeling all hybrid plants, and that hybridization and GMOs are the same thing, because after all, it's just genetic modification. So maybe, I think we're pretty clear about what GMOs are. What are hybrids, and how are hybrids different from GMOs?
A hybrid could exist in nature. You know, given a chance, a plum, what's a pluot? A pluot is
Apricot and plum.
Apricot and a plum. Given a chance in nature, those things could have gotten together and
cross-pollinated and made
a pluot. That is, it's something that could have existed in nature. They were genetically similar enough to be combined in that way. Taking a fish gene and putting it into a tomato is a whole nother, a whole nother game, and it requires really advanced technology. And understandably, because of the technology put into creating these brand new species, which, by the way, are genetically engineered to withstand heavy doses of herbicides or to actually include pesticides within the plant itself. It's not like we're genetically engineering these things for nutritional benefit. So there's a really large difference between, putting plants together that can kind of naturally have, been put together in nature, right? Rather than, you know, injecting a gene from a completely different species into a different species.
Well, I think one of the confusions is understanding the difference between breeding and genetically engineering.
Right.
And breeding is something that farmers have been doing for 10,000 years.
Right.
I mean, that's how we have food like corn. It was bred from a grass. And
so we have domestication. Yeah.
Exactly. So nobody is opposing breeding, but it does seem like it keeps getting thrown up. I'm not sure if this is coming up in the arguments that the opponents of Measure 92 have thrown around this time around, but we'll get to those arguments in a bit. Now, why are you concerned about GMOs in your food? What? Because they also say there's no proven dangers. It's basically the same food.
Right. They'll say that a lot about GMOs. And also, you mentioned opposition, too. I mean, there's a lot of people who like GMO labeling who are not necessarily opposed to all GMOs on their face, you know, given adequate safety testing, long-term safety testing, and say we, you know, they finally genetically engineer something for nutritional value, not to be used for massive herbicide use or include pesticides within. I mean, in that case, say there is some kind of, you know, magically nutritious, genetically modified something, soy, like, you know, you would want to put a label on that. You'd want to advertise that as advantageous, right? So the label is really neither saying these things are good or bad. The label is basic information that enable, you know, citizens to, or consumers to make a choice. That said, there is unequivocal at this point in time connection between genetically modified ingredients, GMOs, and chemical agriculture. You can't differentiate those things. Every single GMO that is on the market has been bred to withstand heavy doses of herbicide, or as I said before, to include pesticide within the plant.
Like BT corn.
Like BT corn is a really good example. BT corn is designed, is defined by the FDA as both a pesticide and as a food.
But wait, BT is organic.
Right. Well, that's the argument that they'll use. It kills bugs. And this is the thing. We don't have really great long-term information about the effects of, you know, BT in humans, but, you know, we're sure as heck eating it, you know. And then the same thing is true of pesticides. We know for sure that pesticides are bad for people. You know, we know that there's a lot of carcinogens in pesticides, herbicides, and plants that have been designed to withstand heavy doses of herbicides they're genetically modified to do so. You spray, you know, all the weeds with Roundup and they die, and then that, you know, corn is still standing or that soy is still standing.
So it's actually increasing the use of herbicides.
Well,
even though they argue that it's supposed to be reducing the use of herbicides.
Right. But they argue that it reduces, but the thing is, after a few years of use, you know, you start breeding superbugs, bugs that resist the Roundup. And this is really interesting. I've gotten some of the really in-depth talking points from the opposition from a few meetings I've had, and it's really interesting. One minute they'll say that this bill would be really terrible for farmers, and they're really concerned about farmers. And let me tell you. Here in the state of Oregon, we have thousands of farmers on our side. We have organizations like Friends of Family Farmers, our Family Farms Coalition, and actual individual farmers, hundreds of them, that have endorsed the campaign.
But not the Farm Bureau.
But not the Farm Bureau, and you can follow the money there. Where the Farm Bureau gets a lot of its money, they're very, very much involved with corporate agriculture. But the family farmers and a huge number of farmers in the state of Oregon really see a benefit to having labels, because then it makes it easier for people to buy local and to choose something that they know is something that they want to be buying. But the other thing that's interesting about the one minute the opposition will be throwing the farmers under the bus, and one minute they'll be saying, oh, the farmers are going to be hurt, and then the next minute they're throwing them under the bus, because when we talked about herbicide use, they said, well, you know, they're just using the herbicides wrong. It's like, well, no, I'm pretty sure farmers know exactly how to follow the instructions that have been laid out for them. And farmers are responsible and they want to be successful for a long period of time. And there's this really great body of data demonstrating that the use of pesticides over the last 20 years and after the introduction of GMOs has gone through the roof. And they're definitely linked. And it's because, you know, no matter how much crop rotation you're doing, like what happens is these pesticides end up becoming immune to Roundup. And that's, in fact, why this is really new news. The last week or so, 2,4-D just got approved for the market.
Which is one of the ingredients of Agent Orange.
Exactly. So we're in an arms race with nature at this point. And the chemical companies, I mean, because Monsanto was a chemical company first and a food company second. These companies are more than happy to develop the next toxic chemical that will wipe out the next, you know, super weed. But what is this doing to our soil? What is this doing to our environment? What is this doing to ourselves? And so anybody who's really concerned about chemical use in agriculture should be concerned about whether or not the foods they're eating are GMO. Because at this point in time, that's what's in the market.
Well, I want to get back to the dangers of GMO, because I have been concerned. I've done a lot of interviews with people, and some guys and women throw out that this study or that study that links GMO food to this or that illness. And I myself, in doing research, have not been able to find anything conclusive about that yet. So I want to, first of all, talk about, do you know of any direct links between GMO, consumption of GMO food, and different illnesses? And if not, why is it so hard to make these correlations? And why should we still be concerned?
I have a somewhat long answer to that question. To begin with, the reason why it's hard for you to find good definitive information is that all of these GMOs have been patented. And so independent research is really hard to come by. If a scientist, you know, America asks for permission to do research on something, Monsanto can just say no, and then they can't do that research, right? So most of the research out there is industry-funded science. You look at big ag universities, land-grant universities, and they are getting a lot of money from the industry to do research. And so we really have a lot of industry-funded science on GMOs. We don't have a lot of long-term studies at all. And we have very little independent testing. And in terms of how these things go to market, arguably we have zero safety testing. And so this is really, really relevant because the American government, the FDA and the USDA do not second guess or even independently test these genetically modified things before they are approved for the market. And that's really significant. And while we have groups like the American Medical Association, which I will say this, the opposition is correct when they say that the American Medical Association does not endorse labeling GMOs. But since they came out with that opinion, the American Medical Association went back and did more research and went back to the drawing board and came out with the opinion now that there should be mandatory safety testing for all genetically engineered foods before they hit the market. And A, that hasn't happened for any single genetically engineered food that is on the market currently. And B, sounds like a great idea moving forward, right? And so while they may not support labeling, they sure as heck support independent safety testing for this stuff because they recognize that there is a potential for harm, an unanticipated potential for harm that we don't know about. Nurses Association, the Oregon Nurses Association endorsed us for the exact same reason. The Consumer Union and Consumer Reports supports GMO labeling because they believe that there is a lack of adequate data to determine whether or not these things are safe for long-term consumption. And they also see an undeniable link between the chemical use and GMOs, which is clear. So basically what it comes down to is for overall public health, the jury's out. We don't have enough independent scientists is what a lot of really reputable, bodies of science and groups and individual scientists are saying. And on another level, allergies. I know this sounds, we're getting super specific, but if a person has an allergic reaction, the way they find out what they're allergic to is they go back and they see everything they ate in that last 24 hours. And if one of those things they ate was GMO sweet corn, but they don't know it was GMO sweet corn, it'll be very hard for that person to determine whether or not their allergy was with the GMO sweet corn or regular sweet corn. So for really basic epidemiological study purposes and for allergy purposes, having this label is really, really important for consumers and people concerned with public health.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Julia DeGraw, who's the Northwest Organizer for Food and Water Watch, and she's also working very hard to get Measure 92 passed, which is an ordinance that would require labeling of all raw and processed food that contains GMOs. Why do you think that Big Ag is pouring so much money into this campaign to defeat it. If it's just about labeling, I mean, we're not, unlike the ordinance that passed in Jackson County and in Josephine County last spring, which bans growing GMO food crops, any food or non-food crops in those two counties. This doesn't ban anything. All it does is require labeling. So why has PepsiCo pumped in $1.4 million? And I guess Monsanto's latest figure is $4,085,150.
Well, it's funny. I really hate trying to answer that question directly because I can't crawl into the brains of you know, Monsanto and Pepsi-Cola. And I have some maybe personal theories. But I mean, at the end of the day, every time any food labeling initiative has been brought forth, or when the federal government has decided to do nutritional labeling, I mean, industry said the sky would fall. They said prices would go up. We can't possibly handle this. It's going to destroy food manufacturing in the country. And it never does. It never does. We add labels to things all the time, and the consumers might shift a little bit. We might buy less, you know, polyunsaturated fats because we found out they're not very good for us.
Polyunsaturated?
I'm thinking
trans fats.
Trans fats. Right. Excuse me, not polyunsaturated.
You want to buy? You want to eat those?
Either way, yeah, trans fats or finding out how many calories are in things. You know what I mean? It's like people might change their purchasing habits, and then the market will adjust to those. And that's what a free market economy looks like. So by that argument, the industry should be excited about labeling because it really actually allows for a free market, for the market to decide, for people to make a choice. But the thing I think what really exemplifies how the current regime benefits the industry is Consumer Reports just recently came out with a study where they researched how many GMO ingredients were in baby food and different like processed foods on the shelf. And they had a really interesting finding where food with the word natural on the label was almost exactly as likely to have GMOs in it as regular food. And to me, that's this huge boon for companies like Monsanto and Pepsi-Cola and everyone else, where they can actually market something as natural and then include genetically modified ingredients in it. They can really mislead people into purchasing something that is, I mean, I would argue it was genetically modified in a lab and grown with lots and lots of chemicals. That doesn't sound like exactly natural to me.
Well, actually, I mean, there's been a large education campaign ever since organics became a legal term, mm-hmm. that natural not only does it mean anything, but it's often greenwashing.
It's totally greenwashing. And this is something that if you're a more educated, you know, consumer, you know that. But if you're, you know, kind of like an average person going to the grocery store, you see the word natural and it makes you feel good. And it's extremely misleading. And so that's why we really support this label, is that it's straightforward and it actually reduces confusion in the supermarket for your daily average consumer. And that's, you know, you'll hear the opposition say otherwise, and that's just, it's ludicrous. It's really basic information. 64 other countries already label foods. And interestingly, American companies that manufacture food in America label for genetically modified ingredients in those 64 other countries. They know how to do it. They already do it. And they should do it for Americans, too. Oregon, we should start in Oregon.
Well, I wonder about all these companies and this list that I received actually from the Yes on 92 campaign yesterday, which lists, it's Coca-Cola, ConAgra Foods, Dow AgroSciences, who are bringing us to 4D, mm-hmm. to counter the effects of Roundup, overuse of Roundup, DuPont, Pioneer, General Mills, Grocery Manufacturers Association, Hershey Company, no more of the chocolate bars, kids, Hormel Foods, Kellogg's, Kraft Foods, Land O'Lakes, at Pure Butter, McCormick and Company, Monsanto, which we mentioned, and PepsiCo. And these, the smallest donation here I see is $58,000, and the other ones are all between $100,000 to $4 million. Mm-hmm. So there's an awful lot of effort on the part of a wide span of the food industry, the industrial food industry, to stop this initiative. If they are so convinced that GMO is good for us, why wouldn't they want us to know on a label that we're eating these ingredients that are good for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they benefit from keeping consumers in the dark. It's easier for them to determine how they make the food and what goes into the food if they don't have to take into account consumer demand.
And so you're saying the consumer demand is starting to demand non-GMO food?
Yeah, and so that's another thing you'll hear from the opposition is we've got these really great labels that already exist, the non-GMO verified and the organic label. Well, that's a complete total, grand total of 10% of the entire market. That's not enough to feed every single person who could possibly be concerned about GMOs. I can't afford to eat an all-organic diet, and I would like to be able to make a choice about what I'm eating. And will I still continue to eat GMO foods every now and then? Probably. I still eat, chips every now and then. I know those are not good for me. I think that there is this fear possibly among the industry that, consumer demand might shift toward fewer, GMOs. But then, that's not, we shouldn't pass laws that protect, industry from having to respond to what consumers want. It should be the other way around. We should have laws that and a free market that enables consumers to make demand what they want and for the industry to respond.
Well, you mentioned about the earlier resistance that the food industry had to just ingredient labels mm-hmm. and nutrition labels. It seems that, particularly, and you mentioned trans fat, well, a few years after those nutrition labels and ingredient labels were enhanced, we see a huge amount of labeling saying trans fat free, mm-hmm. gluten free. I mean, there's a huge market for all these free foods. And so it would seem that maybe they could figure out that they could make a lot of money off of GMO free if they were to set their minds to it. So my question actually is, why aren't they so willing to make the shift to GMO free as they were to make it towards being trans fat free, gluten free, sugar free, all the other frees that we've experienced in the last 20 years?
Yeah, that's one of our arguments is, give consumers information and then find a way to market to them. That's it. The industry will figure it out. No other label in the history of labeling has damaged the industry. I think they can figure it out. This is not rocket science. This is not that challenging. They want the status quo. They don't want to. The thing is, I think it's pretty apparent that they're on the losing side of history. Over 90% of Americans across the United States support the idea of labeling for genetically engineered ingredients. It's happening. not going down without a fight. And I think Oregon is going to be this major turning point for a lot of really incredible reasons. And one of them is that we have just this massive, beautiful grassroots, very diverse grassroots effort combined in this ESN92 campaign where we're going to be able to, knock on people's doors, make phone calls to voters. We have actual people. You look at this list of donors to the No on 92 campaign, and you even look at the Oregonians reporting on it, and they have so few individual supporters still that it still amounts to 0% of individual donors to the No on 92. We have a huge number of donors to Yes on 92, and it's because it's a people issue. People support our side. We have actual human beings that support the right to know what's in our food, and they are going to be the ones that go out there and hit the road and talk to voters and who push this thing to a win, even though there are all these terrible ads being run on the television that, the opposition just doesn't have actual people backing them up.
Well, my concern is that looking at the lessons of history, California and Washington in very recent times went through similar initiatives. They started out in the polls way ahead for yes. Then the money started pumping in, as we're seeing. And both of them, well, California was by a narrow margin. Washington was defeated probably by a squeaker margin. But both of those initiatives were defeated. What do you think is different here? Because, again, we started out back in the beginning of the campaign season, and the yes votes for 92 were like 72%. And the last poll I saw, it's like there's a 4-point margin, which basically means it's within the margin of error now.
Yeah, where you are, we always knew it was going to come down to the wire. And we always knew that when it comes down to being outspent, to the degree that we're going to be outspent, that the number one thing that pushes you over the winning line is field. is really activating your grassroots and getting people on the phones and knocking on doors and Oregonians talking to Oregonians about why they care about this issue and why they're voting yes, because that's far more powerful than some misleading ad they heard from Monsanto where they're saying some really crazy things. And we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah, we are going to get to that.
For sure. But I think the grassroots effort is a lot more organized this time and is really supported by the Yes on 92 campaign. There's this huge blend of like your kind of classic paid campaign and just epically huge grassroots all organized together. We have offices and strong volunteer bases in across the state in Medford and Ashland and Eugene, Corvallis, Bend, and Portland, of course, and Hood River. I mean, we've got people everywhere, and we're going to be knocking on a lot of doors and making a lot of phone calls, and that is exactly the kind of thing that wins against big money. And we also did raise a lot of money because, you know, people will talk about out-of-state funding, you know, as though like our side is bad because we have money from out-of-state or big, you know, companies. It's like, yeah, we have a lot of companies and people all across the United States of America who think that GMO labeling should be the law of the land across the United States. And they recognize that we're not going to win at a federal level if we don't start winning at the state level. And they recognize Oregon as a place where we need to win. You know, a win in Oregon is not just a win for Oregonians. This is a huge step toward GMO labeling for the rest of the country. And so this whole out-of-state funding argument making, you know, like it's supposed to make us look like we're not an Oregon movement. It's like we are, Oregon is the tip of the spear for a national effort to label GMOs. And we just happen to get to make really incredible history here and make it actually happen. So we are able to compete because of the fact that we were pretty successful in fundraising on the airwaves as well. So we have some really great ads. We've got, you know, Michael Hansen from Consumer Union. We have Ray Seidler, who's an EPA scientist who studied GMOs, going out there and, you know, showing us the difference between regular corn and GMO corn. And one's blue and covered in toxins and the other one's not. You know, I mean, which do you want to be eating? He says, you know, if you want to know, vote yes on 92. So we have some really great folks out there doing really, really good work, and we anticipate we'll be able to eke out a win here in Oregon. But it is going to require, I have to put the plug out here, everyone who cares about this issue, you got to go to the Yes on 92 website and sign up to volunteer. Like every single person who cares about this needs to pitch in and actually like make the phone calls and knock on the doors and talk to voters. At least talk to your friends and family, you know.
Well, actually, one thing that I think is really important, maybe more important than a lot of campaigners give credit to, is lawn signs. I think lawn signs are a great morale booster. Mm-hmm. And I was really concerned when I tried to get a lawn sign originally, and they're $10 a piece. And a volunteer at KBOO a couple weeks ago during our pledge drive bought a whole lot of lawn signs, left them at the front of the station so I could bring one home.
They're free now. They're free. You can just get them. Pick them up.
And that's, but I was very happy to see that now there's a big call to put out lawn signs. And I won't do that. That's your job. But I do think that campaigns, they do tend to want to charge for lawn signs in the beginning, whether it's Yes on 92 or whether it was the Obama campaign 2 years ago. I think that should be a line item in the advertising budget and not in the outreach budget and not seen as a line item in the income budget. Mm-hmm. That it really is important to get them out soon. I haven't seen any no on 92 signs anywhere in Portland, which is probably an indication.
Right.
So that you can take that back to headquarters.
Feedback.
Now I want to talk about the misinformation that's being spread by these 12 or 15 companies that are funding these glossy TV ads and flyers. We've gotten a couple of those really glossy flyers. But I want to put this in the context of I was very happy to see the campaign coming back swinging with swinging against the accusations that are being made by the opposition. But I think it's really important not to just be reactive to negative campaigning, basically. And it sounds like you're also putting forward a lot of messages about sort of, I won't call them positive messages, but the reasons why, as opposed to the reasons not why.
Well, and we also led with a lot of our strongest messages that we knew would combat the frankly crazy stuff that the opposition would say. I mean, like from the very beginning, we were, let's have the messages that are the strongest, but also that we know will help combat the misinformation we know is coming. I think I just really there's some there's so many things they say that are misleading. We've kind of addressed the farmer thing. I think just the fact, if you look at our endorsers, obviously this is not an anti-farmer initiative. It just isn't. We have a huge support.
So one of the things they say is that this is going to hurt farmers.
Right. They claim it's going to create this whole new process by which they have to separate their food and how they're growing their food and have, I think they use the word segregation. And I've heard one person say apartheid at some point. I was like, oh my goodness gracious. We already, you know, these American companies already label for genetically engineered ingredients. In 64 other countries. If there was some crazy bureaucratic system or some crazy new way of separating food that needed to occur, it would have had to have happened already for them to be able to label for those genetically engineered ingredients in the food they're already labeling for. So every farmer knows what they're planting. Every farmer, the way this system works is it's an affidavit system. The farmer will sign a piece of paper saying this crop is genetically modified or this crop is not genetically modified. And that piece of paper follows that crop all the way through the food making process.
So that's already happening?
No, that's what will be done under this initiative, under this law. What's already happening is farmers know what they grow and stuff still gets kind of separated like that as it goes down the chain, you know, but it's just not officially documented.
Well, as an aside, in the film that Elaine and I are producing, we're working with these farmers in Tangent, Oregon, who have a large grass seed farm that markets to the world, basically. And then they have a smaller but growing organic farm. So to begin with, both of the wheat, let's say, that's a rotation crop for the grass seed, the commodity wheat is kept separate by all means from the organic wheat for all kinds of reasons. The organic wheat's worth a lot more money to them. So there's motivation to keep it separate.
Right.
But the other part of it is, whether it's the grass seed or whether it's the wheat, they're marketing to countries that don't allow GMOs in to begin with. So they are as concerned about GMO contamination of their commodity crops as they are of their organic crops.
Right.
So is that something that you're encountering with farmers around the state?
Right. I mean, and since most farmers in Oregon are not growing GMO crops, they are particularly supportive of GMO labeling, and I think that's also partly why the ban was able to pass in Jackson County. But yeah, I mean, farmers really definitely benefit from any transparency in the food system that makes it easier to identify something local. And if it's not GMO, then it's probably more likely to be local because we're not growing a lot of GMOs in the state. But either way, it's a really simple affidavit system. It doesn't create some huge new bureaucracy. It's not very expensive for the state to implement. Anytime they say otherwise, I mean, it's just an out-and-out lie. So it's not expensive for the state at all to implement this because of the affidavit system. It's a very, very simple, elegant system that doesn't require a ton of enforcement or creating a whole new bureaucracy. It actually exists under the current labeling regime.
Now, how about the expense to consumers?
Right. Now, that's a real fun one. So I really love to, the best way, I think, to dispel that myth is to actually look at the study. They call it a Cornell study, but if you look at the Cornell study, there's an asterisk at the top of it that says, this is not a Cornell study. It says that, you know, this was paid for by, you know, by the company that paid for it, and is not, it is a company study. It is not Cornell scientists did it for a company. So, but that study with Cornell scientists involved came to the conclusion that the price could go up to, you know, $400 per family per year if labeling passes. The assumptions they used to come up with that number was that the day that the initiative passes, all the food manufacturers are instantly going to have to like wipe everything off the shelves and add and reformulate their foods to have organic ingredients. Organic. Not even just conventional non-GMO, organic ingredients. And that's preposterous. I mean, what will happen is they're going to have a year to comply with the law because it takes about that long to, like, you know, cycle through what's on the shelves and to update
your
label, change your packaging. And then what will happen is over time, consumers may or may not shift in their demand of what they want to eat. And then the market will respond to that. Like there's no requirement under this law that anybody reformulate their food. So even if reformulation is an outcome of the law, it is not mandated by the law and therefore isn't even a consequence of the law.
So how much is this going to actually cost a consumer per year?
So here's the thing. I mean, it's hypothetical. Everything is technically hypothetical at this point, but costs did not go up in the 64 countries where they label. And Consumer Reports has come out with a study. Well, Eco Northwest partnered with Consumer Reports and came up with a study that said, and it was a meta study. They looked at all the studies that exist out there. They did, it's a very, very comprehensive study. And they came to the conclusion it would cost $2.30 per year.
Per person or per family of four?
I think per person.
Oh.
But still, it's like, it's less than a penny a day. It's like, it's really, it's we can handle that.
And that would only be for 1 year, right?
Yeah, and that's for 1 year.
Yeah. So 230, that's less than we're going to be paying for all these taxes. We're
I mean, I think
in.
A cup of, I think, you know, a fancy drink at Starbucks costs more than that. I don't know. So yeah, it's really, and then that, and actually, I'm just mentioning Starbucks made me think of, and that other thing the opposition will do is they'll say that this labeling is inconsistent. Restaurant food won't be labeled. Restaurant food is currently not labeled. I mean, the easy way of looking at this is every single thing that currently has a label will be labeled. I mean, that's it. You know, it's like that's where the label laws apply. Labeling laws apply on packaged food and produce, you know, sold in supermarkets.
And some restaurants do voluntarily label
right.
that it's wild-caught salmon or it's locally grown, or they identify, that's a big thing, and they make fun in Portlandia, of restaurants in Portland that do actually label where, which farm the food comes from.
Yeah, but all of that is voluntary, right?
You right, know, so it's not, exactly.
Stuff is not required.
And I also noticed that, at least in my neighborhood, a lot of restaurants have Yes on 92 signs in their windows. So it doesn't seem like the restaurant business is coming out against this.
Again, you should look at the endorsers. But like, there's not a restaurateur or a chef out there who's like, woo, show me the GMOs. I need more of those. I mean, like, they love this, like, hyper-local sourcing. I mean, people are, there's not a lot of real people or, you know, Oregon businesses that are, like, gung-ho, you know, no on GMO or no on 92.
So what are some of the other arguments that are being made that we can hit on in the next 5 minutes?
Right. So the other one, and I really want to cover this one because it's super, super misleading, and it's a little bit hard to understand. They'll say that things, the ingredients, that foods that don't contain GMOs will have GMO labels. They say that, and they say it with a straight face. And a really the perfect example of how they're getting away with saying that, well, first of all, they're lying. But where the lie is coming from is a really good example is sugar beets. A GMO sugar beet is manufactured into sugar, and then that sugar is used to make cookies. And their argument is because you can't test that cookie to find that protein that proves that it's GMO because it's been so overprocessed you can't find that protein anymore, that those cookies should not have a GMO label on them. But at the end of the day, this is like the really, really simple way of looking at it. A sugar from GMO sugar beets is a GMO ingredient, period. You know, and the way that the law is phrased is the words on the packaging will either be contains GMO ingredients or was processed with GMO ingredients. And that's how we get to the whole sugar from GMO sugar beets is a GMO ingredient. Period. It's just logical. But that's what they mean when they say really crazy stuff like, you know, products that don't have GMOs in them will be labeled as GMO. This is what they're talking about.
Real quickly, we got a caller who wanted to know about meat. So how does this affect
feed.
Meat? Because feed, that's where a lot of GMO
right.
Products come into play.
So unfortunately, labeling for feed is a completely different ballgame. It goes through a different set of regulatory agencies. You have to go through like the FDA. I mean, like labeling for feed is a whole different thing. So we aren't able to label for feed. And that's another thing that the opposition will say is that, you know, milk from cows that are fed GMOs isn't going to be labeled GMO. Well, we eat GMOs. I am not a GMO. Right, even though I eat it, right? So if the moment that we genetically engineer a cow that is making milk, that milk will be labeled GMO. But because labeling for actual feed is something that is outside the purview of this kind of law.
But I do think that the caller raised a good question, and it's a concern. I mean, this goes back to the RBG, the bovine growth hormone mm-hmm. that was really prevalent in cows in cow milk up mm-hmm. until a few years ago, which was also something that they made it illegal to label that it was free of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the first company that I was aware of that put label on their milk cartons was Trader Joe's. I started buying all my milk at Trader Joe's, and then everybody else came along. And it turned out there weren't that many dairies, at least around the Portland area, that were actually using it. But it's I think that we do should righteously have concern about what is fed the animals that we eat.
Oh, there's no disagreement there. Like I think that all I can say is that the limitation of the GMO food label, the informational GMO food label, is that it doesn't contain feed. It just doesn't contain feed. And I agree that it's nice to know what our animals are being fed, but that would have to end up being like a separate...
So after this one passes, then that could be the
next thing. Then we can start going after that. And I think we can also start going... I mean, there's a lot of things. Some people are concerned that like it doesn't label specific ingredients. It's just an informational label saying it includes genetically engineered ingredients. This is what we can pass through a public ballot initiative. This is what the democratic process gives us. And it's a huge... huge, huge step of giving people transparency in their food system. And we can go, you know, if people are really passionate about knowing what their animals are fed, that could be the next step. But it's like, I think when the opposition says things like, you know, we should just vote no for this because it doesn't go far enough, or it doesn't label feed, or it doesn't do that, like you're shooting yourself in the foot for doing any kind of change in the future that you want to see in the food system.
Now, is there really opposition that's genuinely coming from that position, or is that the disingenuous?
Oh, it's totally disingenuous. But it's what they say. They say this doesn't go far enough. It doesn't label feed. It's inaccurate. We've got perfectly great labels that are totally reliable that I'm like are accessible to people with lots of money, you know? So yeah, I think this is about fairness. I would encourage people again to go to the Yes on 92 website, because we have
what is the website?
It is www.oregonrighttoknow.org.
And we have a link to it on the Locus Focus website this week.
And we also, you should just see who's endorsing the campaign. I think that's what's most telling.
Also,
the endorsements are huge. And there are people from, there are Latino groups. We got the endorsement of The Scanner, one of the few African-American newspapers in the state. We got multiple newspaper endorsements, you know, the tide is turning in Oregon. This is not a privilege issue. This
is not a fringe issue.
No, it's not a fringe issue. It's not like a Republican or Democrat issue. It's just people want to know what's in their food, and we're not going to be tricked by these, you know, crappy ads anymore.
Well, in the last moment, anything else you want to urge listeners to do?
Again, if this is an issue you care about, even, you know, if you want the law to go further, it's like whatever it is your opinions might be, if you want to see more transparency in your food system, I really encourage you to sign up and knock on doors, talk to your friends and family, make some phone calls, contact Oregon voters, because that is how we're going to win this thing. It's the only way we'll win this thing.
Well, Julia, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And we've been talking this morning with Julia DeGraw, who's the Northwest Organizer for Food and Water Watch. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or your family to hear this show, particularly before they vote, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. For the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be returning to the break that I thought I was already on. But I'll be back on November 10th. And my guest will be Dominic Delasala to talk about the Tongass Rainforest. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Charlie Hayden, At the Edge of the World, which is a place I think maybe we're finding ourselves. Anyway, thanks for listening, and I'll be back in a few weeks.
To co-sponsor the Portland performance of Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. Carla Lara, Honduran jazz singer, songwriter, and political activist, will be performing at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. She is a working artist, journalist, and feminist in a country where resistance in her artistic life has always been tied to political life in Central America. That's Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. on KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with herbalist Hani Bellabono today about her book, Women Healers of the World, The Traditions, History, and Geography of Herbal Medicine. And then at 11:30, stay tuned for Jenka Soderberg. She will be interviewing Alex Gates, a student at PSU and organizer in the PSU Student Union, about the administration's push for campus security to become a fully sworn police force. And we want to thank you, KBOO listeners, and for all your fantastic support during our recent membership drive. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zengu Farm, every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, herbalist Hani Bellabono, is director of Vineyard Herbal Teas and Apothecary and director of the Bellabono School of Herbal Medicine.